Welcome to Entrepreneur Eats, a conversation about business and community with a side of eats. My name is Deanna Smith, and I'm your host. Have you noticed that Grand Avenue is being renovated? When it's done, traffic will be much easier, and the heart of our business community will be much more beautiful. While it may be more challenging to shop and dine there right now, it would be grand to have you make an extra effort to support the businesses downtown.
Hello, everyone. I'm Deanna Smith, and I am sitting here with Mary Hillebrecht, and I'm so happy that she's here because I'm so proud of her and her family and what they have accomplished over these years, and I can't wait to hear and share all that they have done for all these years. Good morning, Mary.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm very good today.
Good. I'm happy you're here, and I want to share your story. So tell me about Mary.
Born and raised here in Escondido, went through school here, went to college at Cal Poly San Luis and Cal Poly Pomona, was an ag major, been part of the family farm since I was born.
Yeah. So let's talk about going through school. Things have changed so much between the time that you've been in school and I've been in school and my grandchildren are in school.
Yeah.
And all through school, in my experience, there was some kind of agriculture. When I got into high school, there was ag science. And
right.
It was really a great opportunity for us to understand agriculture. How was school for you growing up and being a child on a farm?
We still had a fairly decent farm population. A number of farmers when I was 10 or 12 years old. After the first big water crunch, a lot of people fell away. I think they aged out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
In grade school, we didn't talk about ag, but I was in 4-H from 9 on. And my aunt had been in 4-H before that, so we knew about it. I'd been to the fair with an animal with her.
Mm-hmm.
And just loved it to death, and I always wanted a horse. I never, ever, ever didn't want a horse in my life. And spent hours and hours and hours riding my horse all over the place and hanging out with the kids that had horses in the neighborhood.
What was your horse's name?
Well, I had quite a few. My favorite one was the last one I had named Pal. He was a Palomino.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I had a horse that was a Palomino named Flicka. She was very old and probably my first big horse, and just tolerated everything we did.
Well. What's the difference between Pal and Flicka as far as the size? You say she was your first big horse.
She was just a regular sized horse. Before mm-hmm. that, I had some ponies.
Oh, okay.
And ponies tend to be tough little buggers, and they're pretty crazy, and probably I learned some life lessons with them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to overcome. And then Flicka was just an old deer. And my last horse was a really fine quarter horse that had been owned by a friend who couldn't ride anymore. And he wanted him to go to a good home.
Sure.
So I got lucky there.
Yeah. Tell me about 4-H. What does 4-H stand for in itself?
Started by University Extension, and the four H's are head, hands, heart, and health.
Okay.
And like any youth organization, it's youth-focused from 9 to 19. Now they actually take some younger kids. Some things have changed there, especially part of a family, because a lot of families are involved. And I really enjoyed it because it centered around animals. It centered around other kids that had similar interests. But it was also expansive so that you could learn about things other than just a horse. You could learn about other animals. You could learn about veterinary science. You could learn about photography. You could make a dress. You could model a dress. You could rebuild a car.
Wow, all of these.
We did shooting, everything, but it was activity-centered, family-centered, and it was a wonderful activity here at the time.
So you raise animals and then you take them to the farm. The fair.
Correct.
And what happens at the fair?
We show the animals. Mm-hmm. It's an exhibit. You're there with your animal for about a week, and hard on the parents, but the kids love it to death. And you take care of your animal. You communicate with the people walking by. You enter a competition for the quality of your animal, and then also for how you show. And at the same time, there are other competitions around for who's got the nicest barn display. They have some kids judging contests. There's some fun activities. And all while you're going ahead and collectively taking care of your animals and showing them off to the public.
So it sounds like the ultimate goal is to take your animal to the fair, and you become this little entrepreneur.
Correct.
Where you have taken you're taking your hard work for over, a span of a year or a season.
Yes.
I don't know. And then you go to the fair and you show your animal, and then you put it on for sale or
Correct.
Exhibit, I guess. You put it on for exhibit.
Some things you're taking home. Sometimes there's breeding animals.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a market animal and it'll be harvested for food, is the way we say it now.
Yeah.
You have a chance to see the value of your work.
Right.
The other thing is normally you have to find a market for your animal before you go. You want to round up a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what prize you're going to win, whether you're going to go through the auction, which is reserved just for the blue ribbon animals, or whether you're going to be not in that group. And then you do a private sale. Or maybe you have more than one animal, and they normally only let one animal through the auction that you own. And so you go ahead and, with the rest of your animals, you find a buyer for them.
Wow, that's amazing. So 4-H is so much more than people assume that it is, just, you know, for kids to be out on a farm and raising something for harvest.
And Escondido was fairly suburban forever for
mm-hmm.
me. But those kids found a way to have animals if they wanted them.
Sure.
And it wasn't all of us out on a farm, but we were pretty free-range kids, I guess, also. We ran around, saw each other's stuff.
Yeah.
Rode around the back of pickups and things like that.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah.
If you could tell people about 4-H on how this organization builds little business people or builds great humans because they learn through hard work, determination, not giving up, getting up every day, feeding, watering, doing whatever they need to do to raise that animal. And then they have to do this whole marketing plan and take it to exhibit at the fair.
You're walking out there and showing your animal. It's like a dog show. You
uh-huh.
lead your animal out there and show them off.
Okay.
And the other advantage there is you're in with older kids that are doing the same things you're going to do. You have good examples all the way through. You grow through that. It's about leadership development
mm-hmm.
and about how to get a group to do the right thing at the right time, the right way, all of those things
wow.
at the same time.
That is an invaluable program. More people should know.
I don't know. There are so many people I've seen it touch, including myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was huge, but some of it was the commitment of the parents around us also. It
sure.
was huge. My dad used to, we had a portable scale. We'd go around and weigh all of the animals in the beef group once a month.
Wow.
And that's a 9-month commitment.
So you had a giant portable scale.
Well, I actually, that's...
I mean, how big was the scale?
It
if
looks
you have to
like
put
a single
on
horse
it.
Trailer. And you would lead the cow in there and weigh it.
Okay,
so... And there were about 20 of us in the group for a while, and we even had a contest for that.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever guessed closest to the total weights won a milkshake at 31 flavors on the way home.
Oh, wow. What a great treat. So when you said scale, I envisioned that little square scale that you
yeah.
put on your kitchen counter and you weigh your milkshake or something.
Right. This, and it's fun because we did learn about scales. and about legal weights and measures, mm-hmm. and how things are certified for that, and how scales work, and how the weights and measures system works in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is a
I
very
knew all
serious...
about that when I was 10 years old.
That's amazing. That is so yeah. good. Yeah, that weights and measures. There are people that go to the grocery stores and they actually will take something off the shelf and weigh it. And if it is not the exact weight that that product is labeled as, they will contact that company and they will find them or they'll give them time to fix it. So it's a serious deal.
Our agricultural commissioner is also the sealer of weights and measures in the county.
Wow.
They're related and yeah. have always been.
Well, I hope that 4-H continues on forever because it's creating great humans and it will create amazing adults. So now I want to talk about the Hillebrecht family. Who are the Hillebrecht family? Where did they originate? Where did they come from? How long have they been here?
Well, Hillebrecht's an old German name, and my dad's family came from northern Germany where they farmed. Then they moved to the state of California, Orange County, where they farmed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've actually been here about 150 years farming. We also had some other family that did some things like raise fish up in Northern California from the mid-1800s on. So we've been around.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, within the last 100 years, my grandfather came here when Orange County got too crowded and found a place after World War I
wow.
to buy. And he had a bunch of siblings, so he had some help. They all came down and helped him clear things and set up the water system and get everything going. He planted some tomatoes because he was getting the ground ready for an orchard, but wanted to use that ground while they were developing the ground for the orchard, thought he'd get a cash crop. And was horribly disappointed by it because by the time he had gotten a price quote from a buyer in L.A., picked that crop and loaded it on a truck and got it up there, the price had dropped to a tenth of the quote.
Oh, my gosh.
And he brought the boxes home and never raised tomatoes again and just went ahead and concentrated on orcharding. So.
Yeah.
And he planted a lot of oranges, and then this thing called avocados was a new crop. They planted some of those and planted more and more of them. In Orange County, they had a nursery, and they had grown apricots and walnuts.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had some experience with the orchard crops and with producing the plants they wanted to grow. And we still have some of the original trees that they grew in the nursery.
Wow.
So the pieces... over on my side of the ranch, some of those trees are over 100 years old.
Wow, that's amazing. So you say your side of the ranch. Do you share this area with
yeah.
your sibling?
Yes, we have. There are three. Actually, there are four of us in my generation. All of us own a piece of property of what was part of the original ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all kind of linked physically. And... We help each other, we farm separately and help each other. About 40 years ago, we started selling some things retail. And so we started the farm stand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been what made the difference in us being able to stay here. And there are an awful lot of families that are even still in Escondido that were farming when we were 100 years ago. And some of those families are still here. They aren't farming anymore. And we made some choices about what we were going to do to stay farming and went beyond just the farm gate and tried to do some sales retail. And it's made a huge difference for
That's
us.
That's good. Yeah. So farming is hard and people don't realize that. And I have learned this over time, spending time with the Hillebrecht family. Everybody wants everything right now. And it's like, people don't realize where their food comes from and how long and what efforts it takes to create a tomato or an avocado or an orange yep. or anything, any kind of produce.
That's I brought some produce in this morning to show you, and we're 3 weeks or a month away from harvesting next year's avocados, so mm-hmm. I can't put those out there. I don't have them.
Right.
They're not ready yet.
Right.
And yeah, those trees are 100 years old. We have to take care of them.
Every day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's
and
not
the things that break.
Special occasion. It's every day.
The longer we go, the more things break because they get old.
Sure.
We have to know how to fix those things ourselves mostly. You have to. The other thing is in order to stay in farming, you have to be able to not always make as much money as somebody would that if they had a job or a different kind of business with a different kind of planning. And I think we've been really fortunate because we haven't had huge illnesses that we couldn't deal with or something like that. There have been years when we literally made no money or lost money.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be ready for that.
Yeah. Planning ahead.
And the way the government works its taxes now, it makes it even harder to do something like that.
Mm.
You just have to decide that you're going to keep farming.
Yeah.
It might be foolish, but I think that that's part of it is we decided a long time ago that we didn't want to stop, and so we were going to figure out how to keep going.
Tell me about the challenges of water rights and the expenses of water as a farmer and as somebody who counts on water, not falling from the sky essentially, but because California just came out of a drought and there's not a whole lot of water per se. But, you know, when it doesn't rain, what do you do? Where does that water come from?
Well, here in California, we have a parallel water systems that are run by the feds and the state that bring water to Escondido. And so farmers buy that. The farmers actually used to own a water company, and it turned into a major battle that many people didn't survive. Maybe their survivors were there when the final decision came down, went all the way to the Supreme Court, all kinds of problems. Water's for fighting over, whiskey's for drinking. And it's expensive here. The city of Escondido has really been forward-looking with their water programs. They're really working hard at it. It looks like this recycled water that's coming out to the east side of town is going to be a valuable thing. It's going to be a valuable thing for the city forever. They took the jump, and it's sort of like going to be usable for other things in the future, so they're going to be fine.
That's great.
It's also going to help some of the farmers survive for a little bit longer.
Good.
We use, on our crops, about 3 acre feet a year, and we count on about 12 inches falling. That's huge. That a quarter that nature provides is important. And if we get more than that, we don't have to buy as much. That's important, but the timing is also important. So we can't survive without it. And people have to decide on the administrative decision-making side that it's worthwhile to make water feasible for all kinds of industries, not just farmers.
What are the biggest challenges that you face regularly? I mean, obviously there's the water and taxes and just in general, the weather.
My favorite phrase right now is regulatory hostility. And it seems to be coming at us from all directions.
Mm-hmm.
I can deal with the weather. I can deal with the natural world.
Yes.
We are well trained to do that. The other issues that pop up are increasingly suffocating.
Mm.
And when you compare it to my grandfather rolling up to a brush-filled hillside and using a Fresno scraper, a one-horse Fresno scraper, to rearrange the dirt just enough to be able to plant some trees and irrigate on the contour, and what that would look like today, he never would have done it.
Hmm.
It never would have happened.
How come?
They wouldn't have let him do anything.
Oh, gosh. That sounds ridiculous.
And it's things like, well, if we want to plant a new crop, we usually try a little piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's successful, we plant more. We do more. And if you have to go get a permit to just plant a little bit of something, you're not going to do it.
No.
It's not worth it. And we're being stymied every time we turn around. And the government doesn't take away our things. They don't confiscate it, which is something our forebears were worried about. But what they do is they say, well, you can still own it, but you can't use it. Mm. And you can't use your land that way. You can't grow things that way. You can't water that way. Becomes a problem when you know that it's the correct way to do it. And right. the observations they're making are inaccurate. Mm. So we keep trying.
Yeah. Well, I love that you're not giving up, because we all have to eat. And we all should definitely thank a farmer for everything that they do all day long, every day. Because if we don't have farmers, we won't have, essentially, if we don't have farmers in our town or in our United States, in our country, then we have to depend on somebody else or somewhere else.
Totally a bad idea. The other thing is, as you look back there in North Carolina, where we recently had a huge disaster, and the people who came running were the farmers and construction guys and stuff like that. People know how to do things. Mm-hmm. If all you ever do is work in an office or a bank, or I don't understand what they do as well as I understand what I do, but you have to remember that there are things that go wrong in this world, and you have to figure out a way to get through them. Mm-hmm. And one of the most basic things we do in the United States is raise our own food and sell some to the rest of the world that needs it.
So, I mean, what do? We call our congressman or talk to our mayor. What do we do?
I think that's getting harder. I think that things like this are good, the podcasts and things, but I do wish we had more school-based learning about simple biology, mm-hmm. how things grow, and simple mechanics, how things work. And it could include, when they talk about STEM, all of the things that are interrelated are getting... The high-end colleges are looking at things in one little piece at a time instead of the entire picture. Mm-hmm. And the more of it we can do in a general way for the early education, the better for those people that end up looking at a little piece.
I agree. One thing I have come to discover, I have a tiny farm, and I have learned how to fix a water line. I have not done a single thing with electricity, because that scares me to all, you know, just electricity is very dangerous. But I have built a chicken coop and fence and other things. So farmers are just so well-rounded in almost everything that you could possibly do, minus computer or electronics. But I feel like that's coming, right?
I think, well, you talk about self-driving cars and things. We've yes. had self-driving tractors for 30 years.
Wow.
And GPS-geared tractors for a long, 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 long time. A lot of the bugs have been worked out mm-hmm. on guys that were in a big open field going straight. And we've gotten better about it. The newest exciting technology I'm looking at is a laser weeder.
Wow.
And that's going to be run... with your iPad, you know, all of those things. And we've used computers for things like, you know, information. Mm-hmm. But when technology gets tough enough to be outside, it gets more used. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're getting there.
That's great. That's very exciting. Well, then at that point, a farmer will be completely well-rounded.
Friend, there's a guy on the internet that said, well, why do I do all this? Because I'm broke and I can't pay somebody else to do it. And in this area, it's hard to find people mm-hmm. that know what needs to be done. There are places in the U.S. still where there's a lot of agriculture, where there's more access to more help.
But we need more help here, so... Anytime we can recruit anyone to do something on a farm or learn about something in ag is a bonus. So tell me about food and eating seasonal, and why in the grocery store you could find almost anything year-round, but does it really grow year-round?
There are discussions all the time about eating local mm-hmm. and eating seasonal, and I've watched my older relatives do that, but they've always had the option for buying something exotic from somewhere else. Not as a foodstuff, not as something you ate every day, but as a something special. I've been in some countries where the food was regulated. We laugh. I was in Eastern Germany, and all they had was green stuff, green apples, green carrots, cabbage, and cucumbers.
Wow.
That's what the shelves were full of. Hmm. And then you walked across the border into Western Germany, and this explosion of color. And fruits and vegetables and dried fruit and nuts and everything. And I thought, oh, yeah, we need to go ahead and acknowledge that some things can travel a ways and they can be grown better. We grow things better in California and ship that all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school, we went to Europe, my family, with the band. And while we were there, we saw a carload of our oranges sold by Sunkist.
Oh my gosh, that has got to and be so incredible.
That was an important part of our market. And so we have to be able to move things around the world, mm-hmm. but we have to be efficient about it. And there has to be a reason for it. And it can't be regulated by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There can't be a king that says, we're all going to eat pears today.
Yeah.
We have... in the United States, a huge amount of choices for fresh fruits and vegetables and meats, things that are good for you. I do believe that we're going to swing back around and arrive at it's better to prepare your own food or eat food that's less manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't hurt at all,
yes.
I think.
I agree. So tell me about Mary and your journey of choosing to stay in the farming world, because you went away to college and I'm sure you were exposed to a lot of different things, and maybe you thought about doing something separate or different than farming. What could have been another choice for you, and why did you decide ultimately to come and be a farmer in Escondido?
Well, I think Escondido is a special, blessed place, probably. And what a place for a platform to go out and look at the world. I love to read. I am a voracious reader, and so have studied lots of things. When I was a child, I really wanted to be a veterinarian. I was sure that's what I was going to do. And lots of girls think that. I worked for a veterinarian in town. I did lots with that. I went to an ag college thinking maybe I'd do that. I took some ag law classes. That was interesting. And ultimately came home, worked for Henry Avocado for a couple of years. I worked for the state of California as an ag inspector, fruit and vegetable quality control inspector. And all that while also helped at home.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily for pay or as an employee or anything like that, but everybody dives in when they're there and they're helping. And I just sort of stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you grow? What is your specialty?
Currently, yeah, I just have avocados right now. When I was growing up, we actually at one point farmed 40 different commodities of 5 acres or more, which meant we were scrambling around paying attention to a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of very able people at the time. And we were trying to retail a lot. And we knew that good peaches people would stop for, good corn people would stop for, strawberries people would stop for. So we were scrambling around growing all those things. It got harder and harder to do all that.
Mm-hmm.
So life changed. My mom died. My grandparents grew old and died, and pretty soon we didn't have that older generation helping us. And so things fell off in that regard. I worked really hard with the direct marketing, the farmers markets in the state, and we had our stand in Escondido, and we've just kind of stuck with that, mm-hmm. kept it going.
Yeah, and it's going very well, still.
We try.
Yeah. Everyone knows the farm stand. And if they don't, they're going to know now.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what else? Tell me something good.
Something good?
Yeah.
Escondido's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think what we're starting to see here are people coming out of the COVID fog that we've been in. Mm-hmm. Things are seeming to start to feel normal again. Mm-hmm. People are recognizing each other in the street and when they come to see us at the stand. It's been hard, and I think it's better now.
I think so too. Thank you, Mary. I really appreciate your time and sharing your story.
Thanks for all your efforts.
Yeah, it's what we do as a community. I love my community. Yes on I, investing in Escondido's future. This year, Escondido residents have a question to answer. What kind of community do you want Escondido to be? Measure I is a bipartisan effort led by community members, not politicians. It will add a 1 penny sales tax on every dollar spent in Escondido. The measure would generate about $28 million every year. This money could fund critical priorities like addressing homelessness, improving local streets, sidewalks, and infrastructure, providing police, firefighters, dispatchers, and paramedics resources to protect public safety, and keeping our city safe. The city of Escondido is facing a financial crisis. In spite of a decade of service cuts, city revenue has not been able to keep up the pace with growing costs. If we don't pass Measure I, the city will have no choice but to cut services like the library and the Center for the Arts, parks and recreations, senior services, and the Escondido Police and Fire Departments. Oversight and accountability is at the heart of Measure I. The measure will sunset after 20 years and includes a citizens oversight committee to ensure new revenue is spent appropriately. Essential goods like groceries and medication are exempt from this tax. Bring much needed funding to Escondido, 1 penny at a time. Vote yes on Measure I. For more information, visit escondidocitizens.org.